For the when I first started comedy, it was in an all white room. But along the road, I lost some of my seasoning. And I began to talk more and more like a white comic. Like, hey, how you guys doing? Hey, what's happening, guys? And now when I went to a black audience, hey, how you guys doing? Shut the fuck up, Potsy. You know what I mean? So it was a whole different thing back then, doing a black audience and a white audience. Because you don't know it, but you're, as it's going along, you're pandering to your white audience.
Yeah.
And so when I go to a black audience, they can see that. So I'm telling black audience, you know, who may or may not be from the hood, hey guys, have you ever come to the ghetto? And they look at me like, what? Who is this nigga talking to? You know?
We live here.
I'm trying to. Well, the ghetto was real bad. And then, you know, it's like, oh my God, come on, man. And ultimately, just be yourself. And being yourself is very important. You know, and don't pander to a black crowd or white crowd. Because white comics never have. Never had to do anything black.
Yeah.
And they'll still make it.
Yeah.
Your black comics, you're going to have to confront that black audience. You can't run. You know what I mean? And
what you describe.
Go ahead.
What you're describing is exactly what we went through when we started out comedy. We used to go to, there were no black rooms at all. Let alone rooms that you'd go to if there were no black rooms at all. We'd have to perform in all white rooms, and most of them happened to be Afrikaans. And that pandering was happening quite a lot. And I was one of the few people that went like, we can't live like this. And not even a year into comedy, we started our own rooms, and we built this black audience that started coming, and soon it was crossover and mixed. But I understand exactly what you're saying. It takes a lot out of you not being yourself, especially because comedy is very personal. And when you feel like you're betraying your culture and you as a human being, then it makes that whole 15 minutes, 10 minutes or 30 minutes standing on stage redefine your life as a lie, if it makes any sense.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. It's like, oh man, you get almost, it messes with your mental.
Absolutely.
I'm around all these white guys for the first time. Before I came into comedy, right? I hated white music. White music, I'm like, I don't want to listen to this shit. I wouldn't even listen to white music.
So you don't listen to Phil Collins and Journey?
Oh my God. No. I hated white music. Bug me. And so, and I hate it when I see white people. Like, I love Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Yeah.
Well, the song I know that white people like was September. And then you remember? And I can just visualize dumb white faces singing that song. And it will make me angry. And that's the only song I did not like on, you know, because I see one the very first time on September. And I envision that dumb white faces singing September. I'm like, God damn it. Because Earth, Wind, & Fire, they're for the culture. It's like black.
Yeah.
Well, more and more I got into comedy, and that was a blessing too. And it merged Oh man, music is good, no matter who it's from.
Yeah.
Good music
Yeah.
is good music. But I'm a hood dude. I was from the hood. All I listened to was black music. Now, I did hear the Temptations mention the Beatles, you know, one of that song called Ball of Confusion. You know, fair in the air, tending everywhere. And people say the Beatles new records of gas. And I'm like, huh, who the Beatles? Fuck they talking about? And then I find out who the Beatles were. And, you know, that opened me up. So being in comedy helped me see another stage, you know. Because I'm, you know, we didn't, in Philadelphia, it was black, white, scattering Asians. And the only reason we let them around us because Bruce Lee, you know, because everybody in the neighborhood loved Bruce Lee. You know, we're all right, we love Bruce Lee. And well, when I, you know, I always laugh when black people see Asian people do something and consider black. They call them culture vultures. But we've stolen so much in the hood
absolutely
from Asians, you know what I mean? Well, we walk around with full geese on, like Bruce Lee. What do we think we're doing? And I never went, ha-da! That's what we do. We'd be just like Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
So we were full of, we're all full of shit, really. That's the whole, you know.
Yeah.
So that.
It's not very often that when you speak about a comic to other comics, they all have a story to tell about that same comic, and that guy happens to be you, Keith.
Oh, yeah. I've done a whole lot of shit.
Tell us about your journey in comedy. Where did it all begin?
Philadelphia.
Mm.
Pennsylvania. The comedy factory outlet. That's where everything came forth.
What made you start thinking you can do stand up? Because I've seen people who think they can do stand up, and they definitely can't. And you're one of those people who are just brilliant at it.
Well, I just wanted. My whole thing was the bad comics that I've seen on TV made me feel like, oh, wait a minute, I got a chance. I got a chance.
Yes. How was the Philadelphia comedy scene then? Because, you know, people don't associate Philadelphia with comedy, well, up until recently, obviously. But before, people, when you say comedy, they think of a stand-up comedy. They'll think of New York or Los Angeles, but they'll never say Philadelphia. How was the scene back then?
Wow, you don't have to insult my whole city.
I'm sorry. I know Boyz II Men is from there.
Hey, you really think of comedy. How that has happened? I just went there. And the funny part was, I thought everybody from Philly and comedy was a star. I knew that little about comedy. So I'm figuring, man, if I'm here and I watched all the comics that was going on, I'm like, wowee, these guys are stars. Not knowing, for the most part, knowing they were. But I would see, like, I remember Andrew Dice Clay came to the Comedy Factor outlet. And I seen Jay Leno at the Comedy Works in Philly. So I started seeing real stars to know the difference. But I didn't know the difference between myself and, you know, somebody who was an actual star.
And the transition from Philly to New York or Los Angeles, when did you decide to do that?
Well, I think 1992, I decided to go to New York, to move there. I was just going there in spurts. But in 92, I decided, like, I'm going to do this. You know, I was on a talk show with Chris Rock in like 1990 or 89 or whatever. And I didn't like Chris at the time. And I was like, yeah, this damn Chris Rock, I'm gonna get him. Yeah, don't like the guy. I'm gonna teach him a lesson. We was on a show called Our Voices on BET, Black Entertainment Television Network. Mm-hmm. And it was me, him, and a couple other comics. Now, my whole point was to get Chris Rock.
That's what you came there for.
Well, now when I went to New York to the comic strip, this guy, I thought I'd be good, and the guy told me, I'm not good enough. He's like, you're not good enough. You see, we have a guy named Chris Rock.
Mm-mm.
I'm like, what the? I curse. I don't know my curse on here.
You can. Go ahead.
I said, fuck Chris Rock. You know? You know, well, I'm just telling you the truth. Chris Rock is a guy. I'm like, that motherfucker. I hated Chris just because of that.
Yes.
So, when I'm on Our Voices, a show called Our Voices, and I'm like, yeah, everything he was saying was good. I say it was bad. He's like, oh man, he was on to Eddie Murphy. I love Eddie Murphy. I said, I don't like Eddie Murphy. You know, he stole from Richard Pryor, you know. And of course, Eddie Murphy was one of the greats of all time. But I, absolutely, you know, I wanted to get him. So he said the interviewer asked for like what's comedy like in Philadelphia. And I was like, yeah, I'll get him on this one. I thought in Philadelphia we work out to get better. That's what we do. I don't know what to do in New York. I'm like, yeah, that should get him. And then Chris came back with, well, in New York, we're working for a purpose. We're working to be on HBO, you know, Saturday Night Live, something big. And you probably can see the expression on my dumb face change. Well, you gotta get better. You gotta get better.
You stuck to your guns.
I tried to. But I knew he got me. So, you know, after I went home, I called Wanda Sykes up at the time, right? And then Wanda, we got moved to New York. And wow. So that motivated me to go to New York. And that, you know, it was pretty funny. I'm like, I told Chris that like a while back, like that's what happened. He was laughing, you know.
I like how life has come full circle right now. Because on the day that we're recording this episode, the day after, which is tomorrow, is the launch of the new comedy movie or documentary features Chris Rock and Kevin Hart. And I know how close you are to the both of them. What does that make you feel like? Did you ever think in your life you'd have two comedy giants actually coming together to make a film about comedy?
Wow. Well, I knew I went along. So, you know, Kevin Hart came up under me.
Oh, yes.
Comedy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I brought him and Jay Oakerson to New York together.
Wow. Wow. Literally brought them there.
Yes. And it was funny. Amazing. I went to the comic strip.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm in now. And so I took them to the comic strip where I first hated Chris Rock at. And they want, you know, and start building a whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Chris is like amazing, man. And I remember 2010, right? I'm on a Wanda Sykes show. It's all funny. I'm on a Wanda Sykes show. And my suits weren't the best suits I was wearing on the show. And dumb Chris Rock calls me and they came. You have suits that when you go to a fancy restaurant, they'll give you a jacket to put on. That's how bad your suits are. He said, I'm going to send my stylist to you, and she's going to get you a couple of suits. I'm like, what? You going to do that again? No, but I...
you want me to hate you again? That's what you want right now.
But, you know, I went on Beverly Hills.
Mm-hmm.
I got some pretty sweet suits, which was a lot different from a men's warehouse set, a suit that I was wearing. Y'all probably don't know anything about Men's Warehouse.
But I can only imagine a suit that comes from a place called Men's Warehouse.
Yeah, I know. My suit came with a pair of shoes. The shoes was attached to the suit. If you look at
that's funny.
I was like, God damn it. I'm wearing this men's warehouse suit. And it was too big. And you can see the suit on my Comedy Central special.
No way.
Yeah, half-hour.
I can't wait to check it out. That's what I'm gonna look at after.
The suit
that came with the shoes.
You know what I mean?
You know, just like me, I know you love the process. And also, you have quite a keen eye for talent. You know how to spot what works and what doesn't work. Do you feel like comics recently or now have lost the passion for the process, or do you think we still got it?
It's harder to get that now for the process and putting up clips.
Mm.
And getting something going.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a problem with that, but I'm happy that I went through the process of being funny. Like, comedy's just starting. I kind of feel bad for them because they think if I get real popular, I'm good. If I get a lot of Instagram followers, I'm in there. So they're stuck on that process. I got to do more crowd work, you know. And it got rid of the gatekeepers.
Yes.
So you don't need gatekeepers no more. All you need is a lot of followers. But the process, to me, motivated me more with the gatekeepers. And you're not good enough. I'll show you. When the guy and the gatekeeper told me, you got to watch Chris Rock. Basically, he said, you ain't shit. I'm like, God damn it.
Yeah. But, I'll show him.
Yeah, I'll show him. But you strive to get better and better off that process. And I don't know which is better. I'm for real. Because I would have came up under this process. I don't know. I had a lot of, you know, I probably have a million followers now. But as you can see, I can barely log on to this video.
You know what? What you're saying, Keith, is something that I've been thinking about lately, because I took a few years off of comedy. I came back to it again, and I found that people that I had been watching, or just watching from a distance when I had taken some time off, I'd felt like they missed a lot of the process that I was fortunate enough to get when I started out in comedy. I mean, we did so many clubs. There was no television for us. There was no radio. There was no podcasting.
Right.
The social media was still fairly new back then. It was just Facebook that was popular, you know? So, but other than that, you just had to be funny every night. And we live in a country, obviously, I don't know if you know, that has 11 official languages. So when you show up in a in a comedy show to do a set, you're bound to meet 4 different cultures. But we can universally speak English, but you know, there's sometimes there's things that you can express better in your language or their language.
Right.
And I look back now when I'm doing my shows, I was just in Cape Town now, that I'm able to do a show in English and then add isiXhosa in between, you know, and the people, they understand exactly what I'm saying because they are predominantly isiXhosa, but they do speak English. And when I did one in Johannesburg, in Pretoria, I mean, I was able to add Setswana. And it still worked out. The same set still worked out the same. And the next week I'm doing Johannesburg and I'll be able to add a bit of Zulu. And I do feel sometimes sorry for the generation that missed on that process of understanding the dynamics of the country. And I think most were just...
Different languages, I miss and all that.
Yeah.
From my high school and school.
Yeah.
I can speak one language.
Only what? English?
Broken language. That's all I know how to speak.
So, like you said, I'm a big fan of the process, and I feel like you said, doing it the old school way has taught those kind of comics, you know, that they have and the timing that they have and the ability to connect to different generations of comedy lovers up until now. So, what do you think the state of American comedy is right now?
I mean, it's always going to be healthy because you have those guys that's great.
Yeah.
That before the big purge, the purge of social media came, guys are still pushing the envelope. The younger comics. And the young comics like Sam Morril, Mark Norman, Andrew.
We've had
Schultz,
them both on the show. Yeah.
All those guys are amazing. Monroe Martin, Reggie Conquest, Zainab Johnson. All of them, they know the process. So that makes comedy healthier. And it'll push those guys like Shane Gillis. Amazing. That boy's funny as hell. But all those guys are keeping comedy in a healthy place. You know, comedy is healing itself, and the guys who just are social media stars are being pushed by those guys even
who are
more.
Actually celebrates. Yeah, who are good at what they do and they follow the process.
No, but I think the guys who just go on the internet, there's room for them too to get better.
Absolutely.
I don't hold nothing against them. And because let's face it, if I just started out, right? Like, I'll give you an example. When I first started out, I got a big article in this is how long ago it was, the Philadelphia Daily News, a big giant article. You better watch this guy. Well, now, I took that article and I went to different comedy clubs and say, hey, here I am. And they said, oh, yeah, wow, okay. We're going to book you. How much time can you do? I'm like, oh, about an hour. If I had 10 minutes, you know what I mean? If I had 10 minutes, that would be good. But I told them I could do an hour. So they booked me the headline. And boy, did I bomb. I'm like, well, you know what I mean? Well, that's me and social media when it wasn't social media. I'm like, I can do it. And the guy paid me a big fat $500, which was the most I made so out of anything. And I'm on stage bombing my ears off. And I can hear the other comics, the older comics back then saying, this guy stinks. And I'm like, you know, when you bomb, your mouth gets dry and all that. Mm-hmm. It's like, your mouth gets dry and you sound like I sound now.
What did you learn from that experience, Keith?
What I learned from that experience, you got to write material and get better. You've got to follow that process. But what I'm saying is, if somebody offers you a big amount of money and you're not ready and you're young, you're not going to turn down that money. So if you can pack out arena or theater, when you turn it down and say, oh, no, I'm not ready, keep the money.
No, you'll take it. You'll take the money.
Yeah, being young, yes, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So I don't hold those guys. It's not their fault. I would take it. Just like I said, I just had one dumb article on me, and I went running to Billy and said, hey, I'm really good. I got a 40 minutes to an hour. And the rest of the comments in the back, like, this guy, I can hear him. This guy stinks. And one of those comics was that asshole Rich Voss.
You know, I'll tell you something. I did an interview with Rich Voss about 3 years ago, and about 20 minutes into the interview, he literally took his laptop and he just closed it. He ended the interview after 15 minutes. So He goes, tell me about yourself. And then I start telling him, and I look up into the air, and then I start telling him about myself. And I look back at the computer, and the Zoom call has ended. And then Rich Voss sends me an email afterwards, and he just goes, thanks. And that's just the subject line. And that's it. No context to the email, just that.
He's an asshole.
Let me tell you something. Bonnie, I spoke to Bonnie. I spoke to Bonnie. His wife, and his wife Bonnie is, and I've met Bonnie once, and Bonnie's so sweet. She's such a nice person. And I try to say to him, you know, I interviewed your wife before. The motherfucker literally just closed his laptop in the middle of the interview.
That man. But we'll just hang up on each other. Like, hey, man. Where you gonna be at tonight? Where you gonna be tonight? Oh well,
yeah.
Click, but to log off a computer is one of the funniest things ever.
Keith, there's a story about you, and I don't know how true this is. That I think it was you and Patrice O'Neill were at the back of some comedy club when Kevin Hart was performing, and you guys threw phone books at Kevin Hart.
Oh, yeah. We're throwing stuff at him.
Tell us about that. What happened?
I mean, we told him to go on, yeah, go. You go on, let him go on. And he went on. And we did it just to heckle him. You know, like, tell a million joke. And then go start throwing shit at him. Oh, my God. We did a lot of stuff. What it doesn't top Rich Voss's I can see Josh. Josh takes everything serious. He's probably. Yeah. But when I...
Keith, are you able to tell us about those future projects that you have right now in the works?
Well, yes. Well, you know, the 19th of December, I'm shooting my Netflix hour special.
Congratulations, man.
So that's like literally next week.
What's the theme of your stand-up special that you're doing on the 19th of December?
Oh, since I had two strokes, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm calling it Different Strokes.
Oh, I love that.
And, you know, and you have to show, because really, everybody has a lot of variation of strokes.
Absolutely.
Like Sinbad just had one. I mean, he just had, but he that put him down. Mm-hmm. My hard-headed ass, you know, had a stroke. Yes, trying to get laid. Trying, you know, I'm doing all sort of dumb shit.
Yeah,
and you know, I had my stroke flying from Newark, New Jersey. Arizona. And that's like a 5.5-6 hour flight.
Yes.
And it's how I, when the flight is about to land, I'll pop a Viagra. And, you know, I didn't read up on Viagra and airplanes, but when I got off there, something was wrong.
Yeah.
So, and that's all what it's about. The different strokes that I had.
Ooh.
And how it happened. And like most men will do anything to get laid. We'll go to the most dangerous name. I'll go to Gaza with Hamas. Scythia. Where's Scythia? What? Nigga, this is a Hamas. You want to get laid, you're like, hey, man.
Keith, I must say, it's been a great pleasure seeing you. I love the way you look now. I love the way you sound now. When we first met a couple of years ago, you had just recently suffered your stroke, and it was very touch and go because you had just been to hospital and you're not sounding too good. But to see you like this now makes me very happy, and I'm looking forward to your stand-up one-man show, your special. Where can people catch the show? Where is it going to be streamed?
Netflix. It's going to be on Netflix. And it's going to be good. Something different. Something different. And tells the story. Although I had these two life endangering strokes, I'm still an asshole.
Ladies and gentlemen, from the asshole himself, Keith Robinson. Thank you so much, man.
Thanks a lot. Peace, brothers.
Peace, bro. Peace.
Hey, Wayman. Josh.
Keith.
Don't do it, Keith. Yeah. Don't do it, Keith. Don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. You're going to pull a Rich Voss. Don't do it.
He can't be too far into this call.
I love you, Josh. But I got to do it.
Thank you so much, Keith.
That was funny. Oh, you can take out the headphones.